Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hello, Gary.
Hello, Kai. Did you take any note of the Grammys this week?
Not really. I mean, to be honest, not that I ever did. Why did you? Come on, you've obviously got something.
I just looked at them. I thought Ozzy, you know, getting a Grammy for, you know, best rock metal album or whatever it was you know, best, you know, performance, metal performance. I mean, only that Jeff Beck is on that album. It's possibly one of the last things that Jeff ever recorded.
Oh, yeah, so that's good. But also, I think the Daily Mail gets an award for most ignorant, ill-informed headline ever with unknown blues singer wins a Grammy for Bonnie Raitt.
Don't they get that award every week, though?
Yeah, every paragraph.
And I thought, Harry Styles, I mean, you know, I felt sorry for him. Did you hear about the turntable?
No.
Oh, they had a big dancer's turntable and they've been rehearsing for weeks to do... The turntable is going round and the dancers are on it going one way and then they stop and they fall off and they get back on. And as they came on for the live TV show, the tech decided to turn it the other way.
They probably changed the phase of the electricity.
So the only time I've ever heard of a turntable going the wrong way was when Jimmy Page announced the devil or something.
I buried Paul. also, he got into hot water for something he said, didn't he? About people like me don't win, usually. But anyway, we'll steer away from controversial waters. So today's guest, Tony King... Right? Mm-hmm. Legend, man who was always in the room. I was thinking, Gary, because he's, rather than a musician or a producer, he was more involved in dealing with the artists. For your Bill Frindle stuff today, you see, your stats are quite tricky. Yeah. I think it would be more, he witnessed 700 tantrums, 40 meltdowns, 35 trips to rehab.
And a pigeon crossing St. John's Wood High Street. Yeah. Yeah, no, Tony is someone I've known for quite a long time, actually. And he's just got a book out, The Tastemaker.
It's a great book. It's a fabulous read.
A great book, The Tastemaker, about his life in this business. And, of course, he goes back a long time. And, you know, he goes back to... He worked with Andrew Lou Goldham.
He literally just ran the gamut of everything. Andrew Lou Goldham, then to the Beatles, then back... Oh, no, hang on, was it the Beatles?
Yeah, well, he worked with George Martin, didn't he? Yeah.
And then George, yeah.
He was at Decca Records, he was at Apple, he was the A&R man at Apple. He then worked with the Stones for 20 years. He worked with Elton.
With Elton. Elton was,
it's so many stories. I mean, I don't know whether we're going to get through them all.
I doubt it.
He's a wonderful man, and I know he's a very smart man too. And I feel slightly that I've not worn the right thing. You know, he's a...
You should have said.
Yeah. He might be critical of what you're wearing, Guy. I don't know. You look actually what you're wearing. You look like Zelensky. You look like you're about to give your nightly speech on Ukraine.
Well, isn't this the guy I meant to ask for fighter jets?
No, but you can ask him for a front page of a music mag. Let's get him on.
Welcome to the Rock on Tours.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
That's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
Thank you guys for still being around, still making music, still being into it and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
Well, I get the feeling that us three should go for a pint. That's what I think.
I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience.
Oh, yeah,
get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock on Tours podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Keep on rocking!
King Tony.
Yay! Oh, he's there, he's gone. They sent him there. Yay!
I lost the bloody connection. I was trying to find it, so I had to email Dan and to say, send it to me quick.
I love what I can see behind you, Tony. You've got that fantastic picture of you and John dressed up as Victorians.
In fact, yes. This one, you mean?
Yeah. Oh,
that one.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Fantastic.
You and John Lennon dressed as American sort of Victorians, yeah. I guess.
Because you used to get those done at Universal Studios, didn't you?
And then afterwards, wait a minute, you've started me off now. You're going to have to wait for me. Also, on here is a collage that John and Yoko made for my birthday.
Oh, wow. It's like all cutouts.
Oh, good Lord.
Happy birthday, your royal high jinx. Yeah. What is that?
Oh, very good. Because, Tony, I found on YouTube your Mind Games TV spot.
Yes, it's all over. It's been all over YouTube for quite a long time.
Fantastic. But I'm amazed they didn't do anything about editing the sound because John is so loud laughing
just
in the background.
Guy, just describe what it is.
No, I'm not. I'm going to let our listeners figure it out. It was it's from was it one night of hijinks in LA? You were impersonating the Queen and doing an advert for Mind Games.
I was, indeed.
And your friend recorded it. Sorry.
Tell us, Tony. Tell us,
Tony. It's your story, mate.
Do you want to know the story?
Yeah.
Well, it goes in sequence. I was staying with Mike Hazelwood, who wrote It Never Rains in Southern California and The Air That I Breathe. And we were getting stoned one night, smoking a couple of joints. And I decided to do a sort of Mind Games commercial in the Queen's voice. And we recorded it. We taped it and we were laughing. We were just messing about, to be honest with you. So I said to Mike, we're going to see John tomorrow. I said, let's play it to him in the car. So we did. And he roared with laughter. He thought it was hysterical. Then he calls me up at Capitol Records, where I was working out of, the next day. And he says, would you please do the commercial for Mind Games, dressed as the Queen, with your little message, with your little impersonation that you did. So I said, well, yeah, okay. Up for a laugh, and I had to go down to Western Costume on Halloween of all nights, and there was this really tough broad, you know, like American broad, in charge there, and she goes, okay, so which one of you is the Queen? So I had to put my hand up. It's me.
It's not the first time you've done that, Tony.
And then they had to fit me in a dress, and I was very fussy about the dress. I kept bringing out dresses and I kept saying, no, 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 no. Her Majesty wouldn't be seen dead in that. No, 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 no.
Quite right.
And in the end, I got an acceptable dress. And then, of course, we had to do the commercial in Hollywood in a big studio. And Elton was in town touring. By this time, Elton was bigger than a sliced bread. And he was in town touring and he calls me up. What are you doing today? You know, just checking in. Oh, I'm doing a commercial dress as the Queen. You're what? I said, I'm doing a commercial dress as the Queen for John Lennon. I said, we're doing it this afternoon. Do you want to come? So he goes, I said, John, I'll be there. Would you want to meet him? And he goes, yeah, okay. So Elton rolls up in the afternoon. And there's John and May and Jimmy Iovine and Roy Sakala. Quite an interesting cast. And Elton comes in and I'm in a crown and full makeup. But jeans and T-shirt, I hadn't got the dress on, so I'm like half...
Much like the Queen herself.
You know, you know, yes. Trolling around the palace grounds in your, yeah. in your jeans and your crown, as you do when you're the Queen. Anyway, so I had to introduce them. I'd say, John, this is Elton, Elton, this is John, and I'm in a crown and makeup and all that. And that's when they first met, that day.
But that's quite funny. So if anyone ever asked John or Elton, so where did you first meet?
Yeah. Oh, God. Well, that's a story what Elton would say, for sure.
Yeah. But if it wasn't for you then, in that moment, you know, they wouldn't have made Whatever Gets You Through the Night, or, you know, he wouldn't have got on stage at Madison Square Gardens. You brought
Correct.
Them together.
You know, and then, well, but not at that moment, because that was 1973, but 1974, when John had asked me in 1973 if I would come and work for him in America. the following year. And after a lot of shenanigans with the Beatles to get everybody to sign me off to Capitol in America, they agreed. And Elton said, oh, I'm going to New York on the SS France. You want to come with? So I said, yeah. So I sailed to the New York on the SS France with Elton, who had a music room every day for 2 hours. And he wrote Captain Fantastic all the way across the Atlantic.
Wow.
But he didn't have a tape machine, so he had to keep all the songs in his head. When we got to New York, he had an album in his head.
Were you ever there when he wrote?
I was
anything?
There when he wrote We All Fall in Love Sometimes. That was in Weybridge. It is Wentworth or Raybridge, Wentworth, I think it was, at his little house he had down there. And I went to stay one weekend and he started noodling at the piano and singing. And I went down to the bedroom to fiddle about fussing and everything. And then when I came back to the living room, he said, I've finished the song. Do you want to hear it? So I said, yeah, okay. So he plays me We All Fall in Love Sometimes. Wow. I've got a photo of me actually lying on the sofa listening to it. It's somewhere buried in my photo library. But on the boat, when he did all the Captain Fantastic stuff on the boat, I never heard any of it. He just said, I'd come back at lunchtime and I'd say, how'd you do? And he said, oh, I wrote another one.
Did he have a stack of lyrics that Bernie had given him to take
yeah,
with him?
Yeah, Bernie used to send like a little water.
Telegrams coming in.
And he'd just pick out ones that he fancied doing. Sometimes he'd pick out one and it wouldn't work and he'd chuck it, you know, because he couldn't find a tune for it.
So boats wouldn't pull up alongside with Semaphore, say, this with a new Bernie lyric.
We did have it. We used to read the Atlantic. There's this paper called L'Atlantique that they published every day with all the news. And Elton and I used to treat it like the charts. And we used to say, oh, Cyprus is doing well today. It went up to number three. And
actually, I know on the boat you had Julian Lennon, the young Julian Lennon.
That's right, you were taking Julian over, weren't you?
He told me, because I read that in the book, and he told me that he has very vivid memories of that trip, how extraordinary.
Yeah, Julian came with Cynthia, his mum. Anyway, we get to New York, and we are staying at the Pierre Hotel, and John is at the Pierre Hotel with May, because he, by this time, he was broken up with Yoko for a couple of years, and he's upstairs, and I called him up, and he said, oh, you're here then? This is my first day living in America, work in America. I said, yeah, I'm with Elton downstairs. He said, you want to come up, both of you? So we went up to see him. And he said, I've just finished my album. Do you want to hear it? So, yeah, of course we're going to hear it. So he plays it to us. And then at the end of it, he says to Elton, do you want to sing on anything on this? Is there anything you hear that you think you could contribute to? So Elton and I both looked at each other. We both knew straight away. We both said, well, whatever gets you through the night is the one. Because we thought that was a really commercial tune too. So he said, oh, all right, come down the studio. So a couple of nights later, after we'd been out for dinner with the head of MCA, Mike Maitland, I remember, and Lou Cook, the VP of MCA, we went down to the studio.
Record Plant, was that, yeah.
And we did, and with Jimmy Iovine twiddling all the knobs, we did Whatever Gets You Through the Night, and surprise, surprise, he added some vocals to one of the other tracks. So we did Whatever Gets You Through the Night, and it turned out well. The only thing that Elton said was he had great trouble singing along with John's phrasing. He said he's got a very unusual way of phrasing, and it was, you know, he had to kind of study to be in sync with him, you know, because the phrasing was different. But it got done. And so I went back to LA to talk to Capitol about John's album, because Capitol were looking after Apple Records. And so it was decided that that was going to be the single in the end, after a bit of a debate. And then everybody realized that Elton was so big at that time that it would make sense to put it out. So we did. And then at some point during the course of that, Elton was on tour. He calls me up and he goes, I've got an ask for you. So I said, what is it? He said, do you think John would do Madison Square Garden with me on Thanksgiving? And I said, that's a pretty big ask, Elton. So I said, but I will ask.
Because you, at that point, were looking after John.
I was working for Apple Records, looking after John, looking after Ringo. Mostly Ringo and John I worked for. And George, George really was with Dark Horse Records. So, and he'd gone off in another direction. I used to see George, we were fine. But most of the work was based around Ringo and John, which was enough, to be honest with you.
Beatles.
Two Beatles is enough, you know. Don't get greedy. So anyway, this record came out, and I said to John, Elton wants to know if you do Madison Square Garden. And John said, yeah, if the record gets to number one. He said, rather sarcastically, thinking it's never going to get to number one because he hadn't had a number one in a while. So I told Capitol Records, Al Corey, the head of promotion, I said, can you try and put an extra bit of effort into the John Lennon single? Because if it gets to number one, he said he'll do Madison Square Garden. So it did. It got to number one for 1 week. So I thought,
John hadn't played for eight on stage for how long? I mean, John hadn't been on stage for a long time.
No, he hadn't been on stage for... I think he'd done some charity concert in Toronto for something, you know, with Yoko. And it wasn't... But it wasn't... It was kind of very loose and very casual. I think he might have done something with Elephant's Memory or one of those bands that he was fooling around with at the time, but he hadn't done anything serious, you know, like where you come out as John Lennon, you know, like boom.
Yeah, yeah.
And which was Madison Square Garden, of course. So I said, your record's number one, John. And he goes, does that mean I've got to do Madison Square Garden? I said, well, you actually did say you would. So he goes, okay, then I'll do it. So I tell Elton. Elton says he's got to come to Boston to see the show because otherwise he won't know what he's getting himself in for. So I take John up to Boston. We go in the Starship with Elton, jet, you know, private, nice. And, you know, grub. And we watch the show. John's bowled over. He couldn't believe the sound. Said, oh my God. He said, the sound. He said, when we played Shea Stadium, we couldn't hear a thing. He said, well, these little amps that were nothing.
And it was just the tannoy. It was just the thing that tells you to move your car, is what they were going
for. Yeah, but you couldn't hear anything.
No.
John said, well, we could have been singing anything and they wouldn't have known. He says, in fact, some of the songs we were just fooling around, not singing them properly because all we could hear was screams, you know. Anyway, so he was blown away by the sound. And on the way back, Elton said to John, well, we better rehearse. So we went down to Record Factory, something Hit Factory, somewhere. I forget where it was we rehearsed. I could probably look it up. But anyway, we did the rehearsal and we did Whatever Gets You Through. And then we did Lucy in the Sky. And we were just packing up and Elton said to John, do you want to do another song? He said, do you want to do one of your own? Do you want to do Imagine? John said, no, I don't want to do Imagine. Why don't we do I Saw Her Standing There? We'll do one of Paul's songs.
Yeah.
So Elton said, okay. And then we routine whatever, I Saw Her Standing There, which I played the other day. I played the live version to myself to listen to it. Bloody fantastic. That was
amazing.
God, they were on fire. Amazing.
And so lovely that it's one of Paul's. But I remember because John was so rusty. I remember Davey Johnson said, you know, Elton's guitarist said at the time that like he had to help John get a guitar sound and everything. He'd completely forgotten sort of everything.
Yeah, Davey was a great help.
Yeah.
And John was, you know, he was like slightly like a lamb to slaughter because he was without support. It was just us and the band, but he knew that he had a group of great musicians with him. And Elton, of course, being very, very much in charge, you know, behind that piano, he was very much in charge. And so the rehearsals went well. Show night, John was up chucking a little bit, nervous. And Yoko sent some gardenias and John said, oh, I'm glad. That's nice. That's from Yoko. I couldn't play if she was here. Well, I knew she was there because I got her tickets.
You must have been nervous about that. You did bringing her into the auditorium because they'd separated at that point.
Yeah, but Yoko and I were had become friends because John had insisted when I worked for him that I become friends with Yoko. He wanted me to become friends with Yoko because he described her as a great lady. He said, she's a great lady. I want you to meet her and I want you to go and spend time with her, which I did. And I got on great with her. We had a really, she was much different to what I expected. You know, I was expecting this imperious, tough woman. And instead, she was this like slightly fragile bird, you know.
There's a funny story, isn't there, in your book, where you, when you're staying at the house and you do some washing up.
Well, I was actually I was staying next door at Peter Brown's, who used to, and yeah, I used to go there as my office, and I was walking down the corridor, and there was this glass on a pillar, and I thought, oh, someone's left that there, I'll wash it up. So I took it into the kitchen, and I was washing it up, and John... Yoko came in with John. John was like behind Yoko laughing. He goes, Tony, where, you know that glass on the pillar? Where is it? So I said, oh, I'm just washing it. She goes, oh, actually, it's my artwork. I said, oh, I'm awfully sorry.
It's just won the Turner Prize.
So we just stuck it back on the pillar. It was fine. But John.
But there's also, also the one of art directing the fridge.
Yes. Well, that was... She said one day I came in, because by this time, Yoko, when I was working for them, Yoko had got pregnant with Sean.
Oh, but sorry to go back, but just to follow, didn't that happen the night of Madison Square Gardens?
Well...
I think Sean has said...
It didn't actually happen then, but the fire was lit then.
Right.
Relit, but it didn't take place for another couple of months. But when they saw each other backstage... Because as I said earlier, he didn't know she was there. And then she came back and he said, oh, you were here. And she said, yeah. And so they sat and there's a wonderful photo of him looking at her. And you can only see the back of his head and you can see this look on her face. And you can see it in the photo. You think, yeah, definitely there was some spark that was lit. And by the way, I didn't
back to the fridge.
Finish the show, but it was a fantastic show. Incredible. Mm-hmm. 5-minute ovation, the whole thing. It was totally brilliant. Hopping to the refrigerator now.
Yes, sorry. Yeah.
That's all right. I'm quite happy to jump around so long as you think you can make a program out of it and stick it together. I'm happy. Just send me off. I go off-piste anyway quite frequently, so get used to it.
Guy's gone off-pissed quite a few times, but no more.
Darling.
Not for a long time.
By the way, you're looking good, Gary.
Oh, thank you, Tony. So are you.
Oh, thank you for lying.
No, I'm so in love with the book. I think the book is absolutely... Guy and I both love the book.
Do you like it?
Yeah, devoured it, mate.
We really do. And because I think you just touch on so many different things. I mean, we'll talk about it in a minute, but okay. I mean, also going into, you know, the awful beginning of the AIDS epidemic in New York. Yeah. The way you paint that is extraordinary. But I'm going to remain on the fridge. Also, just want to say, the greatest PR in the world chooses our podcast. We must be doing something right.
Yeah, of course. I know you very well, and I don't know your other young man, but I see him a lot on Facebook in various guises. Don't you play with different people?
I play with anyone. I'm a talent.
Yeah, but I'm often seeing you playing with this one, that one, and the other one, isn't it?
Well, there's a fair few. Well, I play with Gary now. We're in a band together.
But don't you play with Roxy sometimes?
I used to play Roxy music. I've worked with Brian on and off for about 40 years, and then David Gilmour, and I used to work with Pink Floyd.
Yes, exactly.
I've worked with Madonna and all sorts.
You see Roger Waters today?
No, I can't say I noticed.
He's on the cover of Daily Mail.
No, really? No, right. I don't know. No, I missed all that. No.
No. I don't know how much we're allowed to talk about it.
Country.
don't stop that. It's all very involved for me because my son is actually Rick Wright from Pink Floyd's grandson. So it's all very close to home for me.
It's too close to home.
It's close to home. Yeah, let's go back to the fridge. Back to the fridge.
We play with each other with Nick Mason. Yeah. We're in Nick Mason's solo project, which we've been doing since 2018.
Right, okay.
We're never going to get to the fridge. It's never going to happen, is it?
We are going to get to the fridge, I'm determined. Yoko's in bed because she's pregnant with Sean and had been told to stay in bed. So John hadn't He hadn't switched himself off at that point. He was still around. You know, he hadn't become the house husband, but he did eventually once Sean was born. But before Sean was born, Yoko was in bed, and all the food was ordered in, everything. She had a wheelchair next to the bed so she could go down to the kitchen, and someone would push it down to the kitchen. And she says one day, "I've got a refrigerator arriving. Can you, would you mind making sure that they get it to the kitchen without damaging anything, like the bandaged armchair or the glass on the pillar or whatever?"
Yeah.
And these guys from New Jersey arrive with this. You know, when you go to a supermarket, you've got the fridges with the doors.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You reach in to get your milk and stuff. Well, it was like that. It was one of those. So I got it installed in the kitchen. It looked great. So I went back to Yoko and I said, the fridge is installed, Yoko. She said, can I have a look? So I said, yeah, into the wheelchair, down to the kitchen. Okay, now we arrange it. So then I had to put, do you want the tomatoes here? Do you want the milk here? Do you want this here? Do you want she art directed the refrigerator, and I had to put all the different things in different until we've completed it. And it, I must say, it did look fabulous. John came home. He'd been out somewhere. He came home and he went to go to the refrigerator, and Yoko says, "Don't go there." I said, "We've been art directing all the afternoon, John. You can't go to the refrigerator just yet. You've got to have a look at it first." And it is. And then many years later, I was telling the story at backstage at an Elton show around the Roundhouse, around the corner. And my friend said, "I wonder if she still does it." So I sent her an email. I said, "Do you still do your fridge?" And she sent me a picture of the fridge back again.
That's amazing.
I've got it on my phone somewhere.
But I do think she's tapped into something there, because I think to an extent we all do art direct a fridge, don't we? I mean, I know I do. I know I think, that jar would look better up there.
Well, I love arranging my fridge, I must say. And yeah. Ever since then, of course, I've been very fussy about when I open the door, how it looks. And I love it when there's quite a few bits of stuff in and it looks like it's full and it looks like it's busy. I don't like it when it's empty very much, you know, I must say. Yeah.
I've decided if I ever win a Grammy, I'm going to send my fridge to pick up the award. Tony, so Heartbreak Hotel changed your life as a young man.
It did.
What was it like pre-rock and roll? I mean, did the world exist?
Well, I was living in the world of Guy Mitchell and Rosemary Clooney and Dean Martin and Perry Como. That was pop music before. And I wasn't unhappy with it, but, you know, that's what it was at the time. And I didn't think about anything else until one night I'm in the kitchen having a strip wash after the war years, that's what we did. You know,
I never had a bathroom in my house. We had a strip wash always.
Yeah, the only room that was warm was the one that you were living in. We couldn't afford to heat them all. And then we had baby Billings and stuff.
Baby Billings! Anyway,
I'm having this strip wash, and this noise comes on the radio, this incredible, incredible noise of this guy's vocal and this incredible song. Something like I'd never heard before, and it got right under my skin. I thought, what is that? Who is that? And I ran over to the radio to try and tune it, because Radio Luxembourg had really dodgy tuning. Mm-hmm. You were lucky if you got a whole song, because it was always fading in and fading out. So I had to make sure that I heard as much as possible. And then they just said that was America's latest teenage sensation, Elvis Presley singing Heartbreak Hotel. I forget the name of the song. I forget the name of the artist. I go to school the next day. I'm in the bike sheds where we used to talk about Journey into Space and the good show.
And smoke.
I've heard this record on the radio last night. It's going to change my life. It's so incredible. And they all looking at me like, yeah, shut up. And anyway, I read in the Daily Mirror that week, they had a little teeny weeny article saying Elvis Presley, America's teenage sensation, got a gold record for Heartbreak Hotel. I thought, that's the name of the guy. Because Elvis Presley in 1958, 56, England, Elvis, there was no Elvises. that didn't exist in England, Elvis, the name Elvis. I'd never met an Elvis in my life, you know.
Yeah.
It was all David or Tom or Tony or whatever.
But in fact, was there any other, I don't know, are there any other Elvises before Presley that we've ever heard of? If you actually trawl through history, there isn't one.
I suppose there must be.
Yeah.
But anyway, once I knew who it was, I was off and running. I had to know all about him. In the end, I ended up having half a dozen or maybe 10 78s of Elvis before I had a record player. And I used to, I just had them as possessions, and I used to take them out every Saturday night and clean them and read the label.
Oh, that's gorgeous.
Gorgeous. Could you imagine, though, you listen to this record and it changes your life orally. Then you see what he actually looks like, and he looks like a god. What a package you have.
Because surely you'd never seen those clothes. No one's ever seen any clothes like that before. I mean, the way he dressed was incredible.
Well, if you see the very early Tommy Dorsey shows, when before they tamed him down, his movements were just fantastic. I mean, incredible, you know. But it was a little bit like the religious churches when people start responding, you know.
That's where he was getting it from, though, wasn't it? It was.
I think Black
in the same ways James Brown did the same thing. Of
inspiration. Yeah.
Well, he was a combination of the Grand Ole Opry and Louisiana Hayride and Gospel Church, which was what Sam Phillips was looking for with Sun Records. He was looking for a singer who had country and gospel combined, and that was Elvis. Mm-hmm. Elvis couldn't have come from anywhere else in America. It had to be Tupelo, Mississippi. It couldn't have been Hollywood, because he wouldn't have had all those influences in Hollywood.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This episode of Rock on Tours is sponsored by AG1, the daily nutrition supplement.
AG1 is a comprehensive and convenient blend of over 70 vitamins, minerals, and other vital ingredients like gut-friendly bacteria, antioxidants, and much more.
Just one scoop of AG1 daily has all the nutrients you need to support your mental performance, energy levels, heart health, and immune system.
To be honest, it's pretty vital stuff for us, because when you've got a life on the road and you're short of time, or you're too busy to plan and prepare healthy meals, you're getting your podcast together, you're being shouted at, and it's just a nightmare, AG1 gives me all the good stuff and helps keep my energy levels where I need, ready for showtime or doing the podcast, and with a nice vanilla taste.
It keeps me focused, feeling good, feeling healthy with its daily dose of vitamin C and zinc. And it's so easy to use. Just one scoop a day gives me over 70 carefully selected ingredients. Simple.
Trusted by Olympians, F1 drivers and the Rock on Tours. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and a free 1-year supply of vitamin D and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription.
Go to drinkag1.com/rockontours. That's drinkag1.com/rockontours. Check it out.
You go on and work for Decca. Is that your first proper job, as it were?
Yeah, it is. I used to have to commute every day from Eastbourne for the first 3 years because Mum and Dad wouldn't let me leave home.
But you were only 15, weren't you? You were 15 when you got the job offer.
15, yeah.
Yeah, but you had to turn 16 before the headmaster would let you leave.
Yeah, and...
He's off to the back of his room.
Here I am.
Pull something off the wall.
This is me at 15.
Oh, I love that picture.
Oh, look at that.
Oh, my God. That's hand-painted, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
It's in a what I'd call a sort of a drape jacket, a sky blue drape jacket.
With a beautiful leopard skin. I think it's fair to say that this young man has heard of Elvis Presley.
I showed my wife the pictures of you in the book, Tony.
Gary, I have to pause here. Drake is fingertip Drake.
Oh,
come on.
Because when you stood, it had to, your fingertips had to come to where the coat had to land where your fingertips were.
So oh, a drape was longer than that, was it? No.
No, a full drape would have been longer, Teddy Boy's wore, Teddy but this Boy is drape, a fingertip drape.
I showed my wife the pictures in the book of you, and she was like, oh my God, how handsome is he? Yeah. And I write, okay, that's enough, closed it up. I closed the book up, I wouldn't let her look at it anymore. She was absolutely just knocked out by your look, and you've always been an incredibly stylish man, and suddenly you're in this rock business, which is also about theatre and glamour. And I think the first act you get to work with properly are the Ronettes, aren't they? Or is that, as I'm out jumping
the gun. Actually, the first act was Brenda Lee.
Ah, Brenda Lee, coming on strong.
Yeah, I had Brenda Lee, Speak to Me Pretty was the record that we were promoting. And then she came over and she worked with Sounds Incorporated and she routined them. And she was the most incredibly professional and fabulous stage artist. You know, that's where I learned professionalism from. When I saw her working, I thought, that's a whole other league of professionalism. The way she routined a band to get them to play the way she wanted it. She knew exactly what she wanted. And the good people do.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like Mick.
Yeah.
So the Ronettes...
Madonna.
This is how you got to meet the Beatles as well, wasn't it? Through them and Phil Spector, obviously.
Well, I met the Beatles at a broadcast called Pop In with Keith Fordyce, and they were promoting Please Please Me. And we ended up in conversation in the green room, and they were great. I thought they were really fun. They weren't the Beatles at that point. They were a band from Liverpool trying to get a second hit. They had one hit with Love Me Do, which kind of mid-chart record. And then Please Please Me was their first number one. But they were incredibly, you know, I just knew straight away, especially when I saw John, I thought, oh my God, he's so special, that one. And I just knew they were going to be big. They just had it written all over them, you know. And of course, then we had this wonderful party at Tony Hall's the night before they went off for America. You know, they had no idea how it was going to be when they got to America. And at the party was the Ronettes and Phil Spector. And Ronnie was singing along with records, and we played Heatwave by Martha and the Vandellas. And Ronnie sat singing Heatwave. And John and George were looking at her in blank amazement, you know, a real American voice coming from a real American girl, you know. And we had this lovely sending-off party, and they went off to America the next day, and I think two of the Ronettes were on the same flight, but Phil and Ronnie stayed behind. They didn't go because Phil was dating Ronnie at the time. Mm-hmm. And so
George was dating one of them as well, wasn't he?
George dated Estelle later on. Yeah, I went out with George and Estelle one night and Ronnie. We had a night out and we didn't get home till 9 o'clock in the morning, and we took all the food we could find in the cupboard and cooked it.
Where did you go? What's a night out with George?
You'd go to the Scottish St. James with Ricky, the lesbian DJ, who was fantastic. She was brilliant, Ricky. She really... Oh, honestly.
Was she actually called Ricky the Lesbian DJ? I think not.
Well, that's how everybody was like, oh, no, Ricky the Lesbian DJ, you'd say. And she was fabulous, Ricky. And she also rolled a mean joint, so I'd always go and score off of Ricky. And she had a very hot girlfriend called Sadie. But Ricky used to play great records, so you'd stay at the Scottish St. James until 4 in the morning. And then there was this other club on German Street called Dolly's that would stay open late, especially if you were with a Beatle. You know, so George and Ronnie and Estelle and I came in, and George was definitely dating Estelle by this time. And we stayed on, and that's where I first heard the song Mockingbird by Charlie and Inez Fox. They played it, the DJ played it, and I said to George, what is this? And he goes, it's Mockingbird. He goes to the DJ and asks him, and he came back and he signed it and gave it to me. I think I have it. I'm not sure, but anyway, amazing. He gave me a copy of Mockingbird, and we didn't get back to the flat till 7 a.m, I think, and then we had the famous cookout.
The Beatles, you're on the plane with the Beatles. Oh, you weren't personally, but the Beatles were flying to America. And
no, I wasn't. I stayed behind. I was working for Tony Hall. I was promoting records. I didn't go to America till 1972.
But Tony, didn't you used to get the Beatles records, Tamla Motown records?
Yeah, I used to. Well, once I found out what they liked, because we were all like, from that in that generation, you know, people like the Stones, the Animals, Small Faces, me, all the people that were Andrew Oldham, all the people that were around, we all like the same music. We all like American import soul records.
Well, although you did say about how what was interesting when you came across the Stones, I'm sorry to interrupt, is that they were the first people you come across who were from a kind of, it was a different background. It was black American, but they were from this blues background as opposed to a pop background, which is what you and everyone you knew was more from.
Yeah, when I first saw the Stones, I wasn't completely taken in by them. Mm. And it wasn't until later on, once they made Satisfaction. But although I liked The Last Time, I think The Last Time was the first one that I really liked. But then once I became a Stones fan, I became a devotee. You know, I love the Stones.
We all love the Stones.
Before we get on to you working with Andrew Luke Oldham and the Stones, just there was a moment when you looked after Roy Orbison.
Which has the killer story.
Yeah, well, Roy liked German generals' cars, you know, the ones that are in with the running boards, the Mercedes running boards, and the two big spotlights, you know, the headlights that look like spotlights. So I'm going down, I'm taking Roy and Claudette, his wife, out for dinner, which is part of my job. You know, I have to do all the radio, TV, press, and then dinner.
This is Roy's first trip to the UK.
It's like 1960 or something, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure of the dates because he would come and go. He came and go two or three times, but I think it was the first. Anyway, we're going down the King's Road and this car pulls out of the side road and it's one of those cars, you know, the German Mercedes with the running boards and the spotlight.
Star car.
Roy says to me, "I want that car." So I go, "Oh, okay." Taxi driver, stop the cab, please. I jump out the cab, I jump in front of the Mercedes, which is not going very fast, thank God, wave him down. He says, what's up? What do you want? You know, mind you, this was the 1960s, so at least I wasn't threatening. But I said, I've got someone in my taxi who wants to buy your car. Are you interested in selling it? He said, well, I could be. Can I meet him? So I said, sure. So I go back to the taxi. I said, Roy, I think we're in business, so you're going to have to come out and do a bit of a sales pitch. So he comes out, Roy Orbison, recognisable, dark glasses, the hair. And the guy, I think the guy knew who he was, and they had a long conversation. End of story, John buys the Mercedes, and the guy sells him all the spare parts to it, and it gets shipped to Nashville. And many, many years later, I bump into Barbara Orbison at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And Roy, by this time, had sadly passed. And I didn't know Barbara, but I went over to introduce myself because I wanted to just say a polite hello. I said, listen, you don't know who I am. My name's Tony King. She said, you're Tony King? I said, yeah. She said, God, you were a household name with us. She said, Roy used to love telling the story about how you got his Mercedes.
Oh, brilliant. Wow.
And she asked if I'd do the documentary do a bit for the documentary that BBC did, and I did that as well.
Yeah,
but imagine that just around the corner from that, Andrew Lou Golden was walking along and the Beatles were getting out of a cab and I Want to Be Your Man was written, you know.
Yeah,
that this was going on in this little one square mile of London.
But also, I think a really pressing question is, was it right-hand drive?
Yes, it was. I can remember now. It was. Yeah. I had to lean in and talk to him, I think.
Oh, there you go.
What I love about you, Tony, is you've been you've been the man in the room so much.
Yeah.
You've been the guy in the room so much. We'll go on to a couple of other times when you were in the room, but you ended up working with Andrew Luke Oldham because he you were like the only other person to hear this record, right?
Yeah. Well, we have a talk about, you know, he wanted me to come because he wanted to set up Immediate Records and he wanted me to know if I was interested in doing promotion and stuff with him. And he said, I've got a new Stones record we just finished in Hollywood. Do you want me to hear it? So I said, yeah, okay. And then he plays me Satisfaction. I went, oh, my God. It was a Heartbreak Hotel moment. Not quite the same effect, but pretty big. And I went, oh, my goodness, Andrew. That is going to be such a huge hit. And it was, of course. And everybody was, funny enough, everybody was talking about it, including John Lennon. Was at the Scottish of St. James was saying, have you heard the Stones record? It's amazing. And we were all, because it didn't come out straight away. It was a few weeks later it came out. But it was, there was a buzz around London about it. Everyone was saying, oh, you wait till you hear the Stones record. It's amazing. Of course, and then it is amazing, and it came out and became an anthem for that period.
Yeah. And but you've got to tell us the story of when you first met Keith Richards.
In bed. In my office, but I wasn't in bed. I had an office in Ivor Court, which was just still there, just above Baker Street. And we had to, in order to make legally say that we were an office, we had to have a bed in it to say that it's a home as well as
to stay there.
And one morning and the bed was in my office. It was a single bed. And one morning I come in to go to work to my desk. I open my door and there's Keith Richard in bed in my office. So I said to Keith, looks up at me and slightly bewildered look, not having had an awful lot of sleep. So I said, oh, this is actually my office, but do you want me to wake you up with a cup of tea later on? And he said, yeah, can you do that? So I said, yeah, sure. So I shut the door and I went and worked out of another office in the meantime. I went to the reception and worked out of reception, I think, somewhere like that. And then about 1 o'clock, I took him in a cup of tea and he sat up and we had a beautiful conversation about America because I was so fascinated. I was fascinated by America. And I,
of course, it was so exotic.
Just been to Chess Studios, and so he was telling me all about it, and he was really very sweet. We had a really lovely conversation. He was very nice, very sweet, very soft, rather kind of almost shy, and we had this lovely conversation. I've never forgotten it. It was a lovely conversation, all about. He told me so much detail. I think they'd seen Muddy Waters cleaning out the studios. He was employed as a sort of a cleaning man in Chess Studios.
Wow.
Not while they were recording there. That would be...
Well, he'd seen it.
Yeah.
I think
yeah, I guess it was while they were recording.
Something about some of the blues artists used to have to take menial jobs to support themselves, you know, because they didn't have money. They weren't getting... Royalties were not necessarily forthcoming always at that point.
Did your relationship with Keith remain like that always, or did it?
No, of course not, because he became Keith Richards, you know.
Yes, yes.
The Keith Richards that we all know and love, and I knew underneath what he was, you know, and he was always had the underneath all the bravado and the Keith Richard image. He was always a very sweet person. He would act up in front of me sometimes, and I would kind of tease him slightly because he knew that I knew him. And one day somebody said something. Somebody in the organization said something about me that he didn't like, and he stuck up for me. And he said, "Look, I've known Tony a long, long time, and the one thing he's not is dishonest." And I was very happy that he stood up for me, you know.
You went on to work for George Martin while he was recording all the Beatles stuff. And you were actually in Abbey Road, weren't you, when they were making Sgt. Pepper's?
I went to Abbey
and
Road.
All They Need Is Love.
I went to Abbey Road for Abbey Road. I went to both studios, both occasions, and the White Album. But I didn't...
You were there at the All They Need Is Love recording, weren't you?
But I just wanted to mention when you actually had to run an errand for George Martin during the making.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, I had to get a tissue paper because he was doing a lovely Rita, and you know that's I can't do it. There's a sound where he goes, yeah. Well, that's all combs and paper. So George is saying to me in the George Martin posh voice, Tony, would you mind going around the studios and see if you can find anybody who's got some combs? So I had to go rooting around the studios looking for combs for George. And I found some and tissue paper, and we had enough, I think, with only took a couple. And that was what it was. Combs and paper made that noise.
I'd love to know where you got them. What was it? Was it the receptionist had a comb or?
Probably, I don't remember. I managed to round up a couple of combs.
But there is, Guy was referring to that famous film that for the All You Need Is Love. I'm trying to think of the director's name for a minute.
Is it Michael Lindsay Hogg?
Michael Lindsay Hogg.
Yeah, because there's a great picture in your book of you dressed up on your way to the filming of that. Are you actually in the film, Tony?
Yeah, I am. Very briefly. I mean, you blink and you miss it. You know, it pans.
What a moment, culturally, that was.
It pans across the group of people, and I'm one of the group of people. I have a hat on. That's the only way I recognise myself. Dear Michael Lindsay Hogg, I'm still in touch with him on Facebook.
Oh.
He sent me a lovely message the other day about Heartbreak Hotel. It had exactly the same effect on him.
Exactly. Do you know what, well, what I was thinking, because also, of course, your old boss and who we had on here, Andrew Luke Oldham, he had a fantastic, because obviously Heartbreak Hotel was his thing as well. And what was lovely, he said, was being so young, what was incredible about that was, having heard this, never had a heartbreak, never stayed in a hotel. And yet still.
And also, when I got the lyrics finally, and it says the bell hop's tears keep flowing, the desk clerk's dressed in black, I thought, what the fucking hell is that? Excuse me. What the hell is that? What's a desk clerk? What's a bell hop? Yeah. I was reading the lyrics and they didn't make sense to me because I didn't understand what he was singing about.
If he'd said the receptionist, it wouldn't have quite been so sexy, really, though, would it?
Exactly.
What was it like at Apple, working at Apple, Tony? What was that? Was it mad?
Well, I keep reading that I said it was mad, but it was partially mad. It wasn't always mad, but...
you made out in your book that it had been too mad for you to consider working out, but then it seemed like it had got less mad.
Yeah, but when they first started and I was offered a job, I didn't want to go because it was all their friends had jobs, Terry Doran and... Magic Alex with the musical wallpaper and all the
nonsense.
And I thought,
that's who you need for the your speakers guy in your new house. You need Magic Alex come along with his wallpaper.
He said that it was going to have wallpaper that had speakers in or some ludicrous scheme. And then there was Simon and Marika hand painting everything and all those clothes that were rather tacky and badly made.
And weren't there Hell's Angels turning up and stuff? Were you there?
I never went over there much. George Martin's office was right opposite that Apple building, funnily enough. And so I used to look at it, but I never used to go there. I went in once to look at the clothes and I thought they were very tacky and very badly stitched.
Who did you sign anyone for Apple?
Huh?
Did you sign anyone for Apple? Because you were sort of working as A&R, were you?
Yeah. Lolland's Eric Van Eaton, who made a record called Sweet Music that George Harrison produced.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, okay. And they had an album called Brother, produced by Klaus Voormann.
Ah.
And also George Harrison co-produced.
Wow, I should know this. That's fantastic.
I did sign them, and I was working with... But I didn't sign Badfinger, but I used to work with Badfinger quite a lot as well. And... But Lon and Derek were the... Oh, and then I signed up a Cajun record and I played it to Ringo and George. They loved it. I put it out. And you look it up on...
How did you find it? How did you find a Cajun record?
Someone sent it to me. Okay. One of the band sent it to me and he was 17 years old. And the oldest person in the band was about 75 or 80 because Cajun music was generational. They all played, you know... So if you had a Cajun band, you could have a very old person playing and a very young person playing. It was just family stuff. And he sent me this record, and I loved it so much. I played it to George, and I said, you must hear this record. And George said, oh, my God, we have to put it out. And he played it to Ringo, and Ringo loved it, and we put it out. And I had it pressed on 78 just to, as a joke. Yeah. Not as a joke, as a promotional effort. I had it all pressed up on 78. Look up Sundown Playboys Saturday Night Special.
Write that down.
And you'll find it with the Apple label and everything. And I did a whole... I researched Cajun music, and I John Peel loved the record. John Peel played it a lot. And it was a turntable hit, but it wasn't a hit.
What I love about your story, though, Tony, is you don't think, oh, I better stay here and because I'm getting my regular wage. This is my company now. You end up following your nose into various other exciting avenues. So next comes John wanting to
well, work before then, and you moved down to this neck of the woods because I'm outside Lewis here.
Yeah, Lewis.
Right away down
where
here.
Are you?
I'm at Alfriston.
Yeah, I know Alfriston very well because I grew up around there. I grew up in Eastbourne.
That's right, yes. Yes,
and so I used to go to Alfriston and what's the zoo around that player?
Drusilla's. Yeah. That's just up the road here, yeah.
My mum and dad used to take me to Drusilla's.
Drusilla's, honestly, it sounds like a gay nightclub. Right? Sure it isn't.
Definitely. That's a bit Drusilla's. Oh, I was just into Drusilla's, darling.
But also, one thing that's lovely, by the way, because in all this period, because what's really great about what happens with your relationship with Elton is that you've known him all along from before,
yes.
Before it started. That's which is so lovely.
Who?
You know, Reg, Elton.
Yeah.
You know,
because where was he hanging out? Where did you first meet him?
In Dick James Music at the reception area. He was just hanging around the
Drusilla's.
I went to pick up some American records that I used to get sent American records for the Air London artists to see if we could cover anything. I think we did cover Homeward Bound by Simon and Garfunkel. I think there was Roger Cook and Roger Greenaway went under the names of David and Jonathan. And we used to do cover records. And so I used to get American records sent me, and Reg's eyes feasted on these records. And he said, what you got there? And I said, I get sent American records. And we started talking, and I realized he was a big music fan. And we started having this conversation, and he used to come in quite a lot, and we used to talk a lot, and I really used to like him. And then he did a demo for me. Jerry Lorden came in to, who wrote Apache, came in to do a demo, and Elton played the piano. I said, because I knew by this time he was a good piano player, I said, could you play it on a demo for me? And he said, yeah. We did the demo, and Jerry Lorden couldn't reach the notes, and Elton said to me, Ridge said to me at the time, do you want me to sing it? I said, can you sing? And he said, yeah, I can sing. So anyway, he sang it. And then when I took the demo in the next day to Ron Richards and John Burgess at Air, they said, he's got a good voice. Who is that? I said, oh, it's Reg. He's got a good voice, hasn't he? I said, yeah. And then, of course, he went on to become Elton with his good voice.
I know. When you mentioned Paul Simon there, and there's a bit in the book that made me laugh out loud when I think you're at the Grammys. And there's Paul Simon there. And then obviously he was estranged from Art Garfunkel. And then Art Garfunkel gets up to pick up an award. And as he walks by, he goes, I thought I told you to wait in the car.
And John gave the Record of the Year award with Paul Simon.
Yeah. Graceland.
And you had to go and find him in the loo, right?
I'm afraid I did.
What happened, Tony?
Go on, tell us.
Well, come on, you're musicians. You know what goes on in loos, and you're not gay, so...
But who was in there with him?
So anyway, what happened was that John went missing from the table, and...
John Lennon, right?
John Lennon went missing from the table, and Yoko said to me, can you find John? So I knew straight away where to go. So I went to the loo, and him and David Bowie were having a few lines, I think. So I said to John, red alert. And he said, mother. That was, he used to call Yoko mother. And I said, oh, yeah. So he said, I better go back to the table. And he went back to the table, and that was it.
Elton has been incredible in your life. Mm. I mean, he's in the way, in this book, he's the through line. He begins and ends this, because later on, after, oh, I mean, listen, this, we're already an hour in, and we can't eat up all your time, because you're doing so much promotion, Tony. But you know, you go on to work with the Stones for 20 years and Mick Jagger as a solo artist. And then you come back to Elton, don't you?
Uh-huh.
And he really takes you under his wing again.
For Las Vegas.
Yeah, and that's probably one of the most incredible jobs you've had in your life, isn't it?
Vegas, definitely. I took on a job that could have been too big for me, but I just took a deep breath and went for it, you know? Because Elton said, would you like to be my creative director? And I said, well, what does that mean? And he said, I need a Las Vegas show put together. And this was in April, May. And I said, when is it coming out? And he said, September. I said, not an awful lot of time then. So I had to work with Mark Fisher and Patrick Woodruff.
Patrick Woodruff.
Yeah. So Mark did the stage. And then I worked with a guy called Sam Pattinson at Treatment Limited. And Treatment Limited are still big business. They've just done Adele in Las Vegas, and they did.
I worked with Sam Patterson. Sam Patterson did all the videos for the Spandau reunion tour.
Sam's really nice lovely. Guy. He's one of my best friends. We became friends out of doing Las Vegas together. So I started working, and I found it surprisingly easy, because Sam knew all the technical stuff and I knew all the emotional stuff. So I knew what emotions certain songs would bring out of Elton. Like when we did Blue Eyes and we did Images of Elizabeth Taylor, I knew the Elizabeth Taylor that I wanted. I want the Elizabeth Taylor from Suddenly Last Summer. Mm. That is Elizabeth Taylor at her peak. You know you're Elizabeth Taylor. You've got to know when you use Elizabeth Taylor. You don't have something that's slightly over the edge where she's not quite as great, but in Suddenly Last Summer, when she had the swimming suit that got wet, and she looked fantastic, gorgeous. And when we did Mona Lisa's and Mad Hatters, we did all these wonderful images of still images, like Richard Avedon style, because I knew Elton was a photo collector, and I knew that he would love to see a piece up there that was looked like Richard Avedon pictures. Which turned, and the girl who did it made a wonderful documentary called Paris is Burning, which was all about drag queens. It's a fantastic movie.
Oh, I'd like to see it.
It's a fantastic New York, set in New York, about all the dances, the balls they used to have and everything. It's an amazing film. Anyway, she was great. And then it was just so easy. But the one song that I was very fussy about was Don't Let the Sun, because we were doing sort of expanding shafts of light going out, up and up and up. And Elton said to me, are you completely happy with the show? And I said, no, not completely. And he said, why? I said, I don't like Don't Let the Sun, and it's really important part of your, it's the song that kicks off the end, and it's not quite right. And he said, what are you going to do? I said, I'm going to fix it. So I went to Sam and I said, Don't Let the Sun's not quite right, Sam. We have to fix it. And the next day I came in and they'd fixed it. They'd done a beautiful thing. Because there's a key change in Don't Let the Sun. When it goes in the end, he goes up.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It goes up into the last part. And that is the big part of the song when he did, Don't Let the Sun, you know, and he goes off. And so I wanted to make sure that the visuals matched the key change, and they did. And it was beautiful and it came out great. And he always uses that song as a dedication to whoever happens to be visiting that night. And quite often I would get a dedication. The funny thing about that song is he brought the demo of it to me at Apple one day, and he played it to me and he said, I've got my new single. Do you want to hear it? And I said, yeah. And I thought it was fantastic. I said, it's amazing. And he said, do you really like it? I said, yeah. He said, I don't like it. I chucked it across the studio and said, give it to Engelbert. I said, don't be dull. I said, it's a brilliant song. He said, you think so? So I said, yeah. I said, Ringo's in upstairs. This was at Apple, and Ringo had offices, a design company upstairs. And I knew he was in that day. I said, do you want to go up and see Ringo and play it to him? He goes, yeah. So we go up to Ringo's office and we play him Don't Let the Sun Go Down on Me. And Ringo looked at Elton. I said, he doesn't think he's got a hit record here. And Ringo said, are you joking? It's like an enormous hit, Elton. You've got to put this out. So that was it. With certified by myself and Ringo, it came out and became a huge record.
I'm sorry, because I don't know how much time we got, Tony, but I did want to just also mention in the book, because I found one of the most incredible parts of your book was you working for RCA doing disco.
The whole disco thing is fantastic. I was just saying how what's so lovely is that you get brought into disco, but by that point it's got mainstream. But I love the way that you were. You clearly know your stuff on disco right from day one.
Yeah, but how that kind of ends up going into what?
Well, I knew the guy at Colony Records, Ronnie, who was the best salesman in New York, who knew all the disco records. And I used to buy all my records from Ronnie, but I knew I got a lot of early disco right from 72 onwards. Put it where you want it by the Crusaders.
Eddie Kendricks.
Yeah, oh, God, you need a change of mind. God, I went to Paradise Garage one night and Larry Levan, who was the DJ, slammed off all the lights, turned off the sound. So we were all standing there in the dark, and then he brought in the breakdown for Girl, You Need a Change of Mind. The place went berserk. I mean, DJs were artists. They started being artists. They knew how to program. They knew what the drug was that everybody was taking, and they knew when to peak the music to go with the drugs.
And Frankie Crocker as well, obviously. Frankie Crocker was
quite... WBLS was the radio station.
Yeah.
Frankie Crocker. I used to want to go out in the evening. I used to smoke a joint, and I think, oh, I'll go out now. And I could never leave the house because Frankie Crocker kept playing great records. And I was thinking, please, Frankie, play something that's average so I can leave the house.
When we went to America with Spandau Ballet in 83, and True had been a big hit, and Frankie had been playing True. It was why True had become such a big hit, because it was getting played on black radio. He actually introduced us onto the stage that night when we played New York, and I'm so honoured that he was there. It was an incredible thing to have.
True was such a great record. I mean, come on, you know, what a song. And that was a sort of, that crossed over everywhere, didn't it?
Yes, but thank you, Tony.
To this day, I've still never gone a whole day in America without hearing it somewhere, in a lift or something. I hate him, Tony.
I know. Tony, what the disco scene leads into in your book is terrifying, and the way you write about the AIDS crisis and the awfulness of your best friends dying all around you is, I think, one of the best depictions I've ever read of that period.
The best chapter of the book, too.
Yeah, it really is. It ends up really with you lying on a bed with Freddie Mercury, holding his hand as he fades away.
Yes. And I knew, someone said to me the other day, were you shocked when you saw Freddie? And I said, no, because I'd seen it already. Yeah. You know, I knew what it was. I'd seen it. I'd been through it in New York. In 1981, I had just got sober, because I'm a sober man, 42 years nearly now.
Oh.
And so I'd just gotten sober. And then there was this notice in the doctor's office that said there was this pernicious pneumonia going around, and don't take poppers, amyl nitrate, because we think that's what's causing it. Wrong. A couple of months later, people started getting ill with different illnesses and people started dying. And it was just horrible, you know. And I was getting sober, and quite a few people who were getting sober had the virus and got AIDS. And we used to have AA meetings around their bed while they were losing their lives. We used to sit around the bed and share, and they wanted to die sober. They didn't want to drink. They didn't give it. It was so noble of them. But there was so much tragedy going on. I mean, all my neighbors, Bernard, Ellis, Tony, Norman, English gang I used to go out with. God, we used to have fun. Every one of them went, all of them. Fire Island, Michael, Kirk, Bill, Ed, gone. All of them, gone. My dear friend Michael in California, I went to see him. I always tell this story now because it's the most moving part of the story. I went to see Michael, and Michael was my hero. I loved Michael. He and I had become bosom friends. We really loved each other. And he was a very different person, and he made me think differently. He had a big influence on me. And I went to see him, and he was just crying in his kitchen. He had a brain disorder. The virus had caused some problem to his brain, because it caused all different things to different people. You either died of carposis, or you had went blind, or your skin started peeling off, or you had pneumonia. Anyway, Michael stood in his kitchen, and he couldn't move one object from one surface to another, and he was getting confused. And he turned around to me with his tears in his eyes, and he said, I don't want to die, Tony. I don't want to die. And I said to him, what could I say? I knew he was dying. I couldn't say, don't worry, you won't die, because I knew he wasn't. He would. And I didn't say anything. I just stood there silently with him. And within 3 weeks, he'd gone. When I went back to... And luckily, I was in LA on business at the time, and his sister and I still speak to each other on Facebook. And she's already posted stuff about my book, saying how flattered she is that I've mentioned her brother in my book. And I sent her a PDF of the book, so she got to read it ahead of time so she could read about Michael. Because she still, and it was his birthday last week, and we both wished him happy birthday on Facebook together. But it was a very, very, very tragic time. But out of the tragedy came one enormous bit of nobility. It was a guy in San Francisco. There were two areas where the AIDS virus hit the most, which I would call two ground zeros, which is Greenwich Village and the Castro in San Francisco. In the Castro, there was this wonderful guy called Cleve Jones, who worked with Harvey Milk, the mayor of San Francisco, who got shot.
Yeah.
And Cleve Jones had an idea that to commemorate, he didn't like the idea. He found out that 1,000 people had died already, and he didn't like the idea of people going away without being remembered, because there was a lot of prejudice against gay people at that time, a lot. Certain people wouldn't do funerals. Nurses wouldn't necessarily touch you in hospital. My friend James in hospital had lank hair. They wouldn't cut his hair. They wouldn't cut his nails. It's a lot of prejudice. So Cleve had this idea to do this quilt, and it was like a square, like about two foot by two foot square. And you had to embroider stuff on it that reminded you of the person. Well, of course, you know, gay people don't waste time on creativity. And the squares were beautiful. And they were assembled into a giant quilt, and there was 1,950 of them commemorating someone who died. And they were laid out on that stretch of grass leading up to the White House that you often see, It took the entire space of that stretch of grass. And I went on the march. They had a march to support gay and gay rights. In 1987, I went with three of my friends, two of whom died. And we went on the march, and then we went to see the quilt. And you could walk in between the patches of the quilt and look at them. It was so overwhelmingly moving. No one spoke. All you could hear was people crying when they would come across their friends who had died. It was so moving. And now I read up last night, because I thought I'd better be well genned up this on this now. There's 125,000 patches they've got. Wow. I guess it's all rolled up and stored somewhere, and they occasionally bring it out and lay it on a football pitch or something like that. Something huge, because 125,000 is a lot. And that's just the people who bothered to make a quilt. But there are a lot of people, other people who just died, and they died, you know. Anyway, it was a very, very, very heavy, sad moment. And a lot of people who didn't get the virus had what they called survivor's guilt, because they got, you know, all their friends were going, and they survived, you know.
I would feel that way. So if I can just add to that a personal thing I've got. I was working with Madonna in LA in 1989, and I went out with her one night, and I just said to her, how do you find living in LA? Because you strike me as such a New York person. She said, I hate it, but I can't live in New York because all my friends are dead.
Yeah. I met her at a party with Jellybean Benitez when she just had a holiday.
Mm.
And my friend Judy Weinstein, who runs the New York Record Pool, had a party, and Madonna showed up with Jellybean, and there was her first DJ boyfriend, and she spilled some drink on the floor, and she was on her hands and knees mopping up the drink like a housewife.
Good Italian mama.
Huh? Like an Italian, Italian mother, yeah. And I said to Jellybean the next day, I said, your girlfriend's interesting. I said, is she completely together? He said, more than completely together.
Oh, no, was it ambitious? Didn't you ask him if she was ambitious?
He said, yeah, she gets up every morning at 5 o'clock and goes swimming. And I thought, oh, watch out for this girl because she's got careers seriously in her sights.
Tony, thank you so much for coming on this show. This book is a walk through some of the greatest moments in rock and roll history. You get to hold Tony's hand. You see some tragedy as well on the way, but I can't recommend this book highly enough.
This is a Rockonteur's Library suggestion. First highest and highest rated.
Tony, I'd love to come and have tea with you.
Okay. Well, you've got my email.
I'll text you.
Okay, darling.
Good luck with
the book. Am I allowed to say darling on your show?
It's an honour to be called darling by you.
Okay, guys, this was really lovely. Thank you. I hope I didn't go off piece too much and
No, it was fabulous. It was lovely. This is really nice.
Bye now.
Stunning. Good luck with the book.
Bye-bye.
Lots of love. Bye, Tony.
Thanks. I'm glad you like it.
Oh, well, that was just so heady, isn't it?
Vivid. God, so moving at the end.
Yeah.
We should reiterate that, yes, that book is an absolute must read.
Yeah. And there's, it's interesting now, isn't there? Because there's a few people, as you go through the book now, there's a few people that have done Rockonteurs along the way.
Do you know what's really annoying? Do you know why I was feeling really left out, Gary, is that I could only listen. I only had time, because I've been running around so much, I listened to the audio book, so I haven't seen the pictures.
You haven't seen the pictures?
I haven't seen the pictures.
Oh, the pictures are fabulous. He's one of the most brilliantly dressed men I've ever seen. The white suit that he wears on the back of the back cover, you will covet. It is very 70s, but it's right up our street. Anyway, thank you. We will be back next week. Thank you to Ben Jones, our producer, and all of you great listeners. Always, please, we read all the social media remarks that you leave, so keep doing that.
Yeah, so remember, we can wound.
We can what?
Wound.
Oh, we can wound. Oh, yes. Nothing mean, probably.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, till next week, it's good night from me.
And it's good night from them.
Rockonteurs is produced by Gimme Sugar Productions for Warner Music Group UK.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.